Hey, it's Cole Swindell. After I give everything I've got to land a perfect vocal, I usually take five before jumping into the next track. And I've learned exactly how to recharge in that time. Some folks grab coffee. I hit a quick good luck spin. Next thing you know, the break is just as fun as laying down the track. A better break makes for a better take. Need a break? Let's chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello and welcome to Contemplations, and today we're going to be talking about right-wing wokeism, and this is part two, so we're going to be picking up where we left off. Sorry that we had to cut it short. I just normally record in the afternoon, and so I didn't want to keep the production staff behind whilst we finished talking about, because we only got about halfway through. But we've got a decent amount of things to cover today, and we don't have a time limit, so we're definitely going to finish today in all the things we wanted to cover, and we are going to be going over some perhaps more controversial stuff, but with all of that out of the way, I am of course joined by Stelios once again.
Hello.
And I suppose we may as well just get started.
Yes. I must say also that I really like recording in the morning because I'm fresh, and in the afternoon I'm usually tired, and in the symposium that is going to come out today, it's symposium 38, I think, on Zamyatin's Wii that we did with Connor. I was incredibly tired during the shooting. And yeah, I'm happy that we're doing it in the morning right now.
I'm normally the other way around. I'm like a reptile. I've got to warm up slowly throughout the day to be functional by about the afternoon. Yeah. So I might be a bit groggier than normal, but it should be fine. So I wanted to start off by addressing a potential point. I suppose it might as well be worth reiterating first, though, what our notion of right-wing wokeism is, just so everyone's on board. We're not talking about the ideological aspects of wokeism, but just the behaviours that the people who hold those ideological positions exhibit, because it's not just their ideology that is frustrating and annoying, it's the behaviours as well, I think. And so when it's mirrored on the right, I think that this is adopting the progressive left's framing, or the woke left, whatever you want to call them. But it's a problem for us for multiple different reasons. One, it sort of poisons the well of discourse. Two, it puts people off from engaging with us, because if you see someone screeching about how they're right and everyone else is wrong, and how they're, you know, their way of seeing the world is the only way to see the world, then people are going to be like, well, this person is clearly not stable. I don't want to listen to them. And so it's a sort of pragmatic cautionary tale, I suppose. Obviously, we're not saying the way we conduct ourselves is perfectly right. Just trying to identify problems in the world that could easily be solved just by a bit of introspection and a bit of virtuous conduct, I suppose, is the way I would put it. But the thing I wanted to start on would be defining your values based on the views of your political opponents. And this is something that's bugged me for a very long time. I did an article, I think it was in September of 2021, which was titled, As the World Gets Better, Political Discourse Gets Worse. And the world certainly hasn't got better. I'll say that part hasn't aged very well, but political discourse certainly has got worse. And I'm going to read a little bit, rather self-indulgently, from my own article that kind of summarises how I feel. So it says, unfortunately, it is becoming increasingly common to see people justify unfair smears, name-calling and all-around unpleasant behaviour towards far leftists by saying something like, well, they do it to us, they deserve it back. It goes without saying that you do not adopt the moral values of your political opponents, especially when it comes to questionable conduct. The fact the far left behaves in such a manner is a great advantage to the right that should be capitalised on, not copied. The right can present itself as a side of reason by treating people fairly, rather than by imitating the far left, who cannibalise their own for their lack of ideological purity. And the far left is already infamous for this today, which is part of the reason why the moderate left can prefer dealing with the right as opposed to the far left. And we've actually seen this with lots of sort of more moderate left-wingers. I know I wouldn't necessarily call him moderate, but the guy Destiny said that right-wingers are a lot politer to him than left-wingers, who are closer to him ideologically.
Yeah.
And although I don't think people like that necessarily deserve polite treatment all the time because, you know, they posit some horrendous things. But you're going to convince someone, you're going to make people believe you aren't as bad if you are just respectful. It's sort of more fundamental than politics in a sense that people get a read of your general vibe, and it basically boils down to, is this person going to initiate violence onto me? And I think that that's ultimately what it boils down to. If someone's verbally aggressive or verbally more confrontational, people feel more on edge because there's a greater possibility of there being violence, and therefore their body's pumping them full of adrenaline. There are all these chemical signals that are saying, okay, you're uncomfortable, there could be conflict. And even if you're sort of well-versed and you're confident in your ability to fight, you're still less likely to agree with the person, even if they're saying a reasonable point, because they're doing it in a confrontational manner. It's the sort of thing where once a certain threshold is crossed, you kind of guarantee conflict, and there's a sort of deeply seated emotional drive that even if someone is saying everything you agree with, but they're doing it in a way you don't like,
yes,
and that sort of condescending, finger-wagging, aggressive maybe, it's a matter of sort of honour principle, and there's a sort of emotional disgust present with treating them reasonably. And you want to avoid this because you want to make it as easy as possible for the person you're talking to agree with you.
I don't find it at all surprising that people who you can characterize as moderately left-wing say that it's easier to talk to right-wingers because the left has over-intellectualized things for years and has tried to find intellectual solutions to essentially practical problems. And I think that some people on the right are doing it as well today. So, for instance, for me, the issue with the borders and deportations, for instance, when they are necessary, it's a practical problem. Close the border, protect the border, and do what is necessary to do what you promised you are going to do. This is a practical problem. Every time governments fail to do that, it doesn't mean that a new intellectual position is required. So in this respect, I think that a lot of people on the right are mirroring the left. And I think that this is a bit weird because it leads into a situation where people within the right will resemble the left. In what way? In the way that they are so ready to play to the friend-enemy distinction and so quick to interpret anyone who disagrees as an enemy. We will go there. I know I'm not going to anticipate, but I want to say this in advance, that there's a scene from Monty Python's Life of Brian where they're talking about, they're making a satire out of communists and their infinite denominations. Watch it if you haven't already. It's just brilliant.
I'd be surprised if people haven't watched it, to be honest.
Yes, but let's say some Zoomers may not have watched it and stuff like that. But to go back to what you said, identifying your values in the language of your opponent. We did a symposium together with Bo and you and yourself, Symposium 28 on the linguistic subversion of wokeness. And I think that this was a really important discussion, and it is very prevalent. It's very relevant to what we are discussing in these two videos. So speech is always speech in a context. It is speech with language in a society that has, you could say, particular codes of ethics that resemble each other and have frequent overlaps. The terms that pick up what that society in which speech occurs, and they denote the values of that society, they assume a kind of symbolic nature. It's like right, wrong. These are thin concepts. And then you have thick concepts like, you could say, cruel. Or it's not exactly thick concepts, but you have concepts like symbols, like the notion of liberty. And I remember I saw a comment on the promo we did on YouTube. I was advertising Symposium, and someone said underneath, "I'm sick and tired of Europeans who think we're stupid." This was someone from the US. We of course we know what liberty means. We just call ourselves anti-liberals because we need to know what we are talking about, and the left is calling themselves liberals. So two things about this, I think three things about it. First of all, I think that this does show the attitude you're talking about. Second, I never said that I'm addressing people I think are stupid, and I don't think that this person is stupid. In fact, I think that these people are smart. The person who wrote this comment, I do think he is smart or she is smart, and I'm trying to appeal to him or her to think something extra. So this is exactly the audience I'm targeting. I'm not targeting people I look down on. I think that this is precisely the issue, that speech occurs within a context, and we have a very large undecided section of the population in the middle, that every time someone from the right says, well, the left is using this or that label, so I need to take the opposite label. I need to put an anti in front of me. I need to put an anti-liberty, or I need to put an anti-community or an anti-freedom or whatever. They forget that this is a trap. This is bait. Why? Because the majority of the population, or you could say swing voters or something. Swing voters are not always the majority, but they're a crucial part of the population. They look at that and they suddenly link right wing with the destruction of the social order, instead of the left, which the left is really open in various instances about disrupting the social order. But they, when people use the language of their opponents and they start identifying in the language that their opponents are trying to make them use, they're neglecting that there is an audience out there. And the audience out there has this, you could say, subliminal understanding, even if it's not entirely conscious. It has this understanding of terms that are symbols. So if right now, post World War II, the term liberty has become a symbol, the person who identifies as anti-liberal is the person who gets marginal, who falls to the trap that the left is trying to set, and basically gets marginalized by the population. That links this person with the destruction of society and the social order, and allows the people who are very actively claiming in their books and speeches to want to subvert Western civilization and Western society, they allow them to appear as that society's protectors.
That's a very good point, yeah. And I think that people forget that when there is an exchange between right and left, that it's not like, say, you know, a conventional form of warfare, maybe. There are spectators there. There are potential people who are sat on the sidelines that may well join the fight. And the sort of way you win and win decisively a lot of the time is to either rout your enemy or you win over and make them sort of turncoat against them.
Yes.
And people don't necessarily think in those terms. They think of things that are more emotionally satisfying, just like, yes, all that matters is I find the most radical exemplars of my opposing side and exact as much political punishment on them as possible.
Yeah.
And that may be satisfying. It may make the world a better place even, but in the long term, it might not be the best strategy to bring about the world you want to bring about, in that there may be slightly more important things than that which is immediately emotionally satisfying.
Yes.
Even though, you know, at the same time, there is something appealing about it, isn't there?
I know, but I think that what is appealing and what is satisfying is not the best counsel for action.
Of course.
And I don't know, I mean, I don't have an anonymous account on Twitter or something. It's easy for people who are anonymous to just say things. But I think that every person who engages in public discussion has a responsibility to speak what they think is true. And actually, to try and use speech in order to cultivate the behaviors that they want to see, both in themselves and to other people. Because ultimately, if we are talking about the moral corruption of the West or the moral decline of the West or, you know, all these negative terms, what we have in mind ultimately is people practicing particular vices, people adopting bad behaviors. So the question is, how do we try, what do we do when we have, let's say, the limited opportunities to reach out to people? What kind of message do we want to communicate? I want to communicate a positive message.
Well, yeah, because that holds two specific sort of points of worth, I suppose you could say. On the one hand, it moralizes rather than demoralizes people on your own side,
yeah,
to have a positive notion of what the world could be like. And two, it's far more appealing to say to people, this is what you can get if you adopt my way of seeing the world, I suppose. That's yes. What you're trying to sell, right? When talking about politics more generally, not Stelios specifically. And I think that if you were to say, okay, well, here's all that's wrong with the world, from my perspective, is not necessarily a reason for people to say, okay, well, I think your politics are good.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the time, a political coalition isn't necessarily identifying the problems, because once you hear someone identify a problem, you don't necessarily have to subscribe to their worldview.
Exactly.
Whereas a positive prescription about how you want to see the world go, and actually say, okay, I think this, and this are important, and this is how we're going to improve it, then that is something that is more well-founded, yeah, to build a political coalition, I suppose.
I think that this is one of the most important things you have said, because there is a very, very, very basic fallacy that people make, especially on Twitter. I would say that outside Twitter as well. They conflate criticism with the proposal of a solution. There are many people who have, you could say, insightful criticisms of social ills, but they have nothing good to offer as solutions. And so there's a problem here, and that is why I have been constantly saying that when we are judging about practical affairs, and we should always remember that politics is a comparative issue. So practical affairs are not necessarily susceptible to mathematical answers. What do I mean by that? You could say that 2 + 2 = 4. Saying that 2 + 2 = 5 is as wrong as saying that 2 + 2 = 6. But this doesn't occur always in practical contexts. In practical contexts, we deal with non-ideal things. When we're talking about political systems, for instance, we deal with non-ideal situations. People who try to think ideally, they're utopians. It's just, they live in a completely different world. Or they claim they do. But the issue is that they forget this, that it's easy to make a criticism of a particular system. Why? Because systems are imperfect. It's incredibly easy actually to produce a criticism of a system. How? You show that the imperfect is not perfect. Every system has problems.
Literally everything known to man, of the creation of man.
Yes.
Is imperfect,
yeah,
because we're imperfect beings. And this is something that I've quite often had to say to Carl, is that, well, that of course there are going to be problems. No one political system is going to solve mankind's problems because the problem lies within man himself a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And that there are aspects of human nature that are just ill-suited to the ends that we want to achieve, and that, you know, the world we are adapted to inhabit doesn't exist anymore. And so there's going to be a certain amount of dissonance between the modern world and modernity and human beings themselves, regardless of which system you have. And it's also worth mentioning as well that things like technological improvements have very tangible material benefits, but also they have a sort of effect of moving us further away from our own nature. And so it's not entirely clear whether these things are necessarily doing us any good in the long run. I'd argue that they probably are, that it's better to have the technology and be able to choose to either, you know, not adopt it in your own life, although sometimes that's not always possible, of course, or choose to adopt it and adapt around it.
I think that there is... this is also a really insightful thing, because I've heard people who... it's easy for people right now, especially when they criticize modernity and they want to associate themselves with that kind of criticism of the world we're living, it's very easy to generate clicks or to adopt a kind of behavior or rhetoric according to which everything modern is basically wrong and responsible for everything that is wrong with the world and has ever been wrong, like, you know, things like the extinction of the dinosaurs. Yeah, it's modernity that caused it. Well, it's technology that caused the extinction of the dinosaurs, yeah.
The movement of time.
Yeah.
But no, the point I always try and make with this sort of thing is that quite often the argument will be that technology is making people incentivizing immorality. But if your environment can shape whether you're moral or not, then you're not moral. Being moral is being moral despite your circumstances. Otherwise, you're not moral.
I think that there is an interesting element of truth in the criticism, that because how we become habituated in our environment does contribute to the kind of person we become.
Of course.
So it seems to me that the world we live in does contribute to the people we are. But it is a significant mistake to point at something and say, this factor over here, within this imperfect context, we have an imperfect factor. And this imperfect factor is actually blamed for everything bad. Okay? That's a mistake as well, because you could also say that the lack of that factor could bring you threats. So, for instance, fire. Fire can burn us, but without fire, we would be burned. And this is why, honestly, I get pissed off every time I hear about the myth of Prometheus and used in a pejorative sense. Oh, this is Promethean. Sorry, no. Of course, I'll try to use fire in order to make the world better and try to navigate myself in it. What else is there? Yeah, honestly, no. This is just complete nonsense for me. Just saying everything, okay, it's Promethean. Yeah, okay, without fire, you would freeze to death. So learn how to use it. Technology is the same thing. Okay? It can be used for good, it can be used for bad. This applies to everything. You could say a kitchen knife. It can be good, it helps you in all sorts of ways, it can be used for bad. It's very easy, and I would say incredibly myopic, to pick something and try and present it as being the main source of trouble everywhere. Because that's the issue. If you present, it's sort of resembles far left thinking. Let's find one thing and blame everything on it. Blame everything on technology.
This is one thing that really frustrates me, particularly my sort of research methodology brain, is that when you're learning to be a practicing research psychologist, like one of the very fundamental first things they tell you is, obviously human beings are very complicated things. If you think a phenomenon is caused by one factor, you're probably wrong. And that, you know, things are normally multifactorial and very complicated, and the interchange between factors quite often can be mediated by other factors. And you get a sort of picture of the necessary complexity and resolution you need to see the world in to be able to understand it in the first place. Like, simple psychological phenomena that aren't even the conscious phenomenon, therefore a bit more fundamental because they're closer to human nature, still have very complicated webs of factors that contribute towards them. And so trying to understand a society and how it's motivated, well, that's, you know, hundreds, thousands, even millions of human beings, all with their own individual multifactorial system running, if you're looking at them individual per individual basis, and then the sum total of all of that. How on earth are you going to look at all of that data, all of that information, and say, you know what, I plucked out this one thing, this is what explains it. Yeah. Whenever you hear someone saying, this is caused by this and this alone, that person is stupid. That is 100% true all of the time. That's a joke, by the way, because I'm expressing massive certainty about the importance of uncertainty. So yeah, don't take that seriously. But there is still a point there to be had.
There is room for jokes, and this is something that gets lost mm-hmm. in certain areas. Yeah, and certainly. It's important to have them, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But my point being is that whenever something is reduced down to one factor, that I know Peterson has talked about this before, then the person's deliberately reduced that conversation to be so low resolution that it allows them to provide a convincing rhetorical device. And I think that that's ultimately what it is that person wants to convince the people they're speaking to that they know what they're talking about.
I think it is, ironically, an element of utopian thinking. It's, think of many people who grow old and they give the kind of advice to, you know, their offsprings. And their offspring, you know, their children or grandchildren ask them, you know, father, mother, grandparent, whatever, what should I do in life? And sometimes some of them are bitter and they think that if only I had that one thing, everything in my life would be perfect. So, for instance, you have someone who's old and sometimes resentful and says, well, I didn't pursue my dream. So if I did it, everything else would be perfect. And I think that this kind of mentality is completely false, because we miss that the things that we said no to, sometime if we had we said yes to them, a lot of other stuff in our lives would be different. Okay, for some people, that means that they should have made better choices. But I'm talking about the kind of person who just focuses on one issue and misses the forest for the trees. And this happens very frequently in context of values. There is a bias to think that there is only one and only one fundamental value, the one that is currently under threat. And this kind of thing, this kind of bias, unless we're aware of it, it leads us into extreme types of low resolution thinking. So for instance, right now, it's community that is at stake. So suddenly a lot of people are forgetting all other values like liberty, forget it. No, it's demonology, it's demonic. Okay? Sorry, I'll have none of that. None of that.
Yeah, I think that because of the abstract nature of values and how for many people, their manifestation of virtue and their values is in behavior rather than, you know, consciously thought out and formalized, then they find it difficult to identify which virtues and principles they actually value until they're threatened, until their absence. It's like you don't know what you value until it's taken away. It's that sort of phrase, isn't it? And so I think it's a sort of defensive mindset. I don't think it's necessarily that helpful, although certainly some pushback on certain values is still important. There is a purpose to it. I think that also seeing the bigger picture and seeing which virtues you hold dear, things like, I don't know, truth might be under threat, and therefore it's very formalized in people's minds that it's valued, but some of the other ones might not be. Like, I think very few people are thinking, oh, it's a virtue to be materially satiated.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.